Hi, and welcome to The Chat. My name is Leah Somerglue. Each week on The Chat, we shine a light on the lives and careers of UTS alumni here at the 2SER studios. This week, my guest is Alice Collins, who is the director at Insight Communications, which is a boutique public relations consultancy firm. Alice has worked on campaigns such as Where's William, which is raising awareness of missing toddler William Tyrrell, and other campaigns around asbestos and ovarian cancer. Why did you decide to study a Bachelor of Media at UTS?
Well, I originally actually started off doing a criminology degree at UNSW, and I did a minor in film theory and absolutely loved it. So I thought, I don't know about this. And I had half the year off and decided to apply to UTS and didn't think I'd get in, and I did. So, and it was fantastic. Perfect uni for me. Perfect subjects. I loved it.
Tell me about your time at UTS media. Was there anything apart from, I guess you graduated and you're working in PR now, but at the time, was there something that you were particularly interested in? Did you just want to get into PR?
No, I did no PR subjects, believe it or not. I did a lot of journalism and advertising subjects. So I think those subjects that I studied, as well as my MAP stuff, has actually stood me in good stead with my PR company that I have with Mum, because we work with the not-for-profit sector and they are notorious to have very small budgets. So you do need to be a master of many things. And I find that the skills that I learnt at UTS have been hugely beneficial across the board. So
being able to work creatively with a small budget.
Yes, or often no budget.
Yes. sounds like you should work for 2SER. Take us on as a client. So what made you want to get into PR after you graduated? And you just said, I mean, you do have Insight Communications with your mum, which you've been running for many years, I think even since you
since 2008.
Yeah.
So my first, while I was at uni, I was working as an usher at the Lyric Theatre, which I loved. And my boss was leaving, and her boss, I was chatting with him and he said, oh, so what are you doing? I explained, I just finished my comms degree at UTS, and he said, what do you want to do? And I said, look, I'm not quite sure. And he said, you love the arts, don't you? I said, I do. He said, would you be interested in working as a publicist? I said, why? He said, well, my daughter is working with a woman called Judith Johnson, and she was the leading theatrical arts publicist at the time in Australia. And so I went and had a chat and a coffee with Judith over at Milsons Point, and we connected and she offered me a job, and it was fantastic. So that was my first real job outside of after I'd graduated. And we worked on wonderful shows, and I was working on Priscilla, the world premiere. And tragically, she passed away 5 nights before opening night. So I had to get the show up and running. And we had, even at a funeral, I was looking after media crews. And
because
it was pretty full on. And it was certainly a baptism of fire, because I'd been with her for about 6 months. So I really enjoyed working in publicity, and I got lots of offers from different advertising and marketing agencies for the arts. So I went and did that for a while and really enjoyed it. And my mum was heading up the comms department at the Sydney Children's Hospital Foundation, and she wanted to go out on her own, and she just wanted to do, you know, consultancy. And I nagged her and I said, can I come with you? Because I'd always been helping her with her projects ever since I was a kid. And nagged and nagged and nagged constantly, told no, no, no. And in the end, my argument was, well, fathers and sons have been working together for centuries. Why not mothers and daughters? And she couldn't argue with that. So we set up Insight in 2008. And since then, we've just gone from strength to strength and done some really wonderful campaigns. We specialise in cause, culture, community, health and awareness campaigns. And we do government stuff as well. So everything we do has a social benefit. We can't just sell products or do commercial stuff. So it doesn't get us out of bed in the morning, whereas that stuff, it doesn't pay much, but it's really soul-fulfilling.
Why did you decide to work for the not-for-profit sector over other sort of more corporate brands?
That's a really good question. I think it's because it comes down to mum's and my upbringing. We both have always been hugely passionate about, you know, the underdog and actually achieving something positive. Our accountant wishes we were less generous with our time, but it's just, it makes you feel really good. I was one of the one of our clients. We set up a we're setting up a not-for-profit for an arts youth organisation, and we were interviewing prospective board members. And we were sitting with this guy who's an incredible IT guy from Adelaide. He's got his own web development company. Like, he designs programs which builds computers and all sorts of stuff. So he's really cool. And we were sitting there talking about what sort of projects that we worked on and doing the whole intro stuff. And I said, we just finished the Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month campaign earlier in the year. And he said, did you do the Teal Ribbon one, isn't it? And I said, yeah, that is. He said, did you do the Teal Ribbon Woman's Day by any chance? I said, yeah, I did actually. Yeah, you saw that, because you're not exactly my target demographic. He said, actually, I need to thank you, because I my mother had been experiencing the symptoms of ovarian cancer for a long time, had seen multiple doctors, wasn't getting anywhere, and she read the stories that were in your in the edition. So we had a number of case studies, we had ambassadors, we had health journals, health articles. So it was quite a compact issue. I think there were about 11 or 14 pages in it. And he said, Mum identified with what was in that, and she went to a new GP, took a magazine with her and said, this is what I got, I'm sure of it. And she got diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and as a result she was able to get treatment, and so they had another 5 years together. So it just really hit home the value of effective communication. So I I'm on a panel in the Ecology of Public Communications, which is a subject which May Hansford runs, and I do that twice a year. And I often, in my wrap-up, I say, with communications, you don't actually have to be a doctor to save lives or an environmentalist to save the environment. You just need to be an effective communicator in order to, change the world one piece at a time, so to speak. It's a bit corny and cliche, but it's actually really true. So you really don't know how far your messages go out there. It's a ripple in a pond effect, and that's what I really like, because I don't know exactly how many people's lives I've impacted, but I know that I helped at least Mark and his mum. So that's great for me.
Let's talk about the ovarian cancer awareness campaign. How did it come about? Did they approach you?
They did. Most of our clients approach us. We hardly ever go out pitching for clients.
That's a good sign. You're doing a good job.
Yeah. And it was funny, the week before, Mum, my colleague Ellie and I, we were sitting around saying, look, appreciate how fantastic Pink Ribbon is. Everyone's aware of breast cancer, but there's a lot of other cancers that affect women that are really deadly, and there's not enough resources for them and not enough awareness. And I said, I'm just actually sick of everything being pink. What about the other things? And literally a week later, we received a phone call from the COO saying that we've seen some of your work, and we would like to have a chat to see if you'd be interested in working on our campaign. And this was in December, and their campaign was for Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month, which is February. And of course, over Christmas, everything's closed. We were closing down. And so we had to pull together a campaign really quickly and go through a list of all their ambassadors that they had on their book to see which was the most recognisable publicly, and we took them from that point on, and we did two years of campaigns with them, and both campaigns won awards. So we're pretty happy with how that actually catapulted them as a brand nationally, because they were originally, when we were working with them, they were a very small operation operating in a suburb in Melbourne above a shop. I think there was about three, maybe four staff, that was it, and now they're fully functioning. They've got all this space down in Melbourne, and they've gone from strength to strength.
And what were the campaigns, if you want
to? Okay, so the first campaign was our 11th hour campaign. So what we do is when we're developing a strategy, we look at the what are the key messages of the organisation, what is the campaign for, trying to align them. And the main message was to educate women about the symptoms of ovarian cancer and why it's important, because most people don't, A, understand what the symptoms are, or B, know what to look for. So we looked at all the different symptoms, and we looked at all the numbers, and statistically one Australian woman was dying of ovarian cancer every 11 hours. So when you think about the phrase, don't leave it to the 11th hour, we thought that was really key with this message, because most women were finding out in that late stage, and we wanted to stop that so that people could be diagnosed early on so they had a better survival chance. And so that's how we came up with the 11th hour concept. And what we then did was to leverage community engagement, we created the 11th hour ambassador program for them, which is just normal everyday women who haven't necessarily been touched by ovarian cancer, because every woman needs to know the signs and symptoms of ovarian cancer. And so we had Jean Kitson, the main ambassador, who is an incredibly generous woman. She is funny, passionate, and just a delight to work with. And we only had a couple of weeks to pull it together. And so what we did was we got 11 women from all walks of life. So we made sure that we had different people from different ethnic backgrounds, different professions, and we activated them within their own personal communities, within their professional communities. We held a media call at 11 o'clock on top of one of the buildings opposite the Broadway Shopping Centre. So we had the 11 o'clock time in there, and it was really, really fantastic. And just that one media call, we generated, I think it was about 180 media clips just from that one. Wow. And it was done on the eve of Australia Day, because we wanted it to be an Australia Day health message. So it really got the message out there. It kicked off the campaign, because at that time of the year, the 1st of February, there's all these fantastic, wonderful stories about the Australians of the year that were from Australia Day. And so we wanted to try and leverage that. So that's what we did with it. And it worked a treat. And the following year, we expanded that and actually had that in every state and territory except for Canberra. So, and it was really, and we had one from pretty much every single profession. Like, we even got dancers from the Australian Ballet. We had a winemaker in WA. We had vets. We had miners. All sorts of people. So it was a way of being able to filter your message out there to areas where most people actually overlook there's a need. So yeah, that was that campaign.
Do you think that sometimes that sort of star power of, you know, say your Jean Kitson's having those ambassadors, does that sometimes help?
It does. It does. It really does. It helps give a voice and an identifying feature for media, because quite often media are really, they're limited to time and space, and even more so now, especially with 10 today. And so if they've got someone that's high profile, interesting and engaging, they're more inclined to pick up your story. And especially if you've got somebody as delightful as Jean Kitson, who is just a delight is really the only word you can use to describe her. She's just fantastic. So she's really passionate and committed, and she just sells the message really well.
Why do you think it's important to tell the not-for-profit story?
I think it's important because at the end of the day, we are a community and we are society, and we don't exist in silos. We actually interact with everybody, and it's important to remember that there are people that are disadvantaged, that there are people that have less fortunate than yourself, and you don't know what's around the corner. And I think it's important to be aware of your social conscience, I think. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily think of themselves outside of themselves. And I think it's important that people actually start to do that and make a difference. It doesn't take much to make a difference in your community.
Can we talk a moment about the Where's William campaign, which is about missing toddler William Tyrrell?
Yeah.
Was this a difficult campaign for you to work on? How did you get involved with this one?
It's an incredibly difficult campaign. It's still ongoing.
It still is, yeah.
It's still ongoing. So we got approached by William's family. They're very good friends with one of Mum's really good friends.
So it's a personal connection.
We didn't know them at the time.
Yep.
And we were asked, has there been any sort of similar campaigns and the benefits, etc. And so we did some research, and there hadn't been. And so they said, would you be interested? And so we sat down and chatted with them and said, yeah, this is what we can do, and what if this is something that would be of interest. And we sat down and we talked with the lead investigator, and he said, yep, this stuff would be really beneficial. And so we rolled out the campaign. We didn't have much lead time, so we met with them in mid-May, I think it was, of 2015, and had to roll out the campaign in June. So I think we only had about 5 weeks. Maybe it was late May that we met with them, and we had to develop the brand. We had to liaise with a number of different organisations. It was quite intense.
Yeah, how do you go about approaching something like that? How how do you even begin?
You just dive in. You dive in. You don't sink. You just keep swimming.
Yeah.
So, yeah, lots of challenges, hugely emotionally draining at times, but also rewarding knowing that you're actually doing something that makes a difference.
And the campaign sort of received almost an extra second wind, almost a boost, just recently, only like a couple of weeks ago,
yes.
with Chappelle Corby.
Yes,
featuring,
Chappelle Corby.
Wearing a bag featuring William Turrell on the front of it. He's still seeing the
media understand that it was a pure publicity stunt on her behalf.
Yep.
So it's kind of died down, which is actually quite a good thing. So our campaign runs in cycles depending on what's needed, etc. So we're kind of limited with what we can and can't do. So to say it was a shock and surprise is an understatement.
Do you think that all publicity is good publicity, as they say?
No, not all publicity is good publicity. Brands, identities, etc., can have serious repercussions with some elements of publicity. And I think the stunt that Chappelle Corby did backfired on her, quite frankly.
Let's move on to the asbestos awareness campaign.
Yeah, that's easier to talk about.
What was the message that you wanted to get through, and why did you think it was an important message?
More Australians will die of mesothelioma than died fighting in World War One. So that, or an asbestos-related disease. That's pretty frightening. And the proliferation of home renovation programs, Australians love to do things themselves. Mesothelioma is one of the few cancers which is entirely preventable. You don't expose yourself to asbestos, you will not get it. So it's an important message to get out there. And I guess it was a message that wasn't getting out there. And we looked at the campaign when we were approached in, I think it was about 2010. And there was a lengthy process to pick up the tender. And the original campaign was Think Asbestos. And when you hear Think Asbestos, you go, oh, ding, Think Asbestos, that must be a good thing, when in actual fact, no, it's not. So we rebranded as Asbestos Awareness, Think Smart, Think Safe, thinkasbestosawareness.com.au, because it's not worth the risk. And the campaign has been hugely successful. We're running it now since we launched the new website in 2011, and it's just gone from strength to strength. It's now a national campaign. We've received a number of awards in Australia and also internationally with it. We were requested to go and meet with ministers at Westminster in London about the importance of the campaign. We've met with groups in Germany, the Netherlands, France. We've had delegates from Japan come and meet with us. So it's what we're doing with the campaign is very different. It's specifically targeted at homeowners and renovators, whereas in other countries they mostly target they mostly target tradies essentially.
Yep.
And so we've created a whole campaign about don't play renovation roulette, because it's not worth the risk. We've got fantastic ambassadors like John Jarrett, Don Burke, Cherie Barber, who's our first female ambassador, which is fantastic.
Yep.
She's known as Australia's Renovating Queen. And she is a divine woman who donates so much of her time. And she's just committed to raising awareness. We've got Barry Dubois. We've got Scott Cam, Scott McGregor. So it's a really good team. And they're all dedicated to saving lives and preventing mesothelioma and asbestos-related diseases.
So the issue around asbestos in Australia with sort of your home renovators, it's about, I remember reading a few years ago, it's about the underlaying carpets.
Yes, yes. See, that's the big thing. Most people think, oh, I don't live in a fibre house, it doesn't affect me.
Yeah.
Couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah.
So it was one, it's a miracle product, really. It's fire resistant, it's temperature resistant, it's water resistant. So it's a really good product in that respect, except it kills you. And it was widely used in all parts of the house.
Yeah.
So it was used as carpet underlay. It was used as the backing of tiles. It was used as the as on like brick homes in the eaves of the houses.
That's right.
It was used in hot areas like chimneys around fireplaces. It was used absolutely everywhere. And so most people think, okay, I'm just going to save a few bucks. I'm going to rip off these tiles, pull up the carpet, and not realise that they're actually exposing themselves to potentially deadly fibres.
And is it sort of a typically Australian sort of issue? We kind of went gung-ho with asbestos,
we did.
It seems.
We did. Australia was the largest consumer of asbestos cement products in the world at the time. And it was a cheap, versatile product. They put up, with everyone coming home from the war, they just put up houses to provide accommodation for the returned servicemen, as well as, like, you look at more affluent suburbs, like the eastern suburbs and even around the northern suburbs, you've got these beautiful brick homes, but they've got garages which are made of fibro. Mm-hmm. It's because they bought the car and they needed somewhere to put the car, so they just knocked up a fibro shed. And so it's really quite interesting. You look at the evolution of, like, with cars and all that sort of stuff as well. It's quite fascinating the way the use of the product within society and how widely it was used and what sorts of products. It's been used for centuries. The Romans used to use it as nappies, and they used to just throw them in the fireplace to sanitize them. And they knew back then that the miners who were mining the product were dying of some lung disease. So it's been known about for a very long time.
It's so interesting how you know so much about, I guess, the subject matter of your campaigns as well.
Well, you've got to, because it's an extension of you. So our philosophy is you need to know the brand like it's your own. Yeah. And because we've been doing it now for a number of years, we know it inside and out. But there's still constantly learning, constant new things. So, which is really interesting. We're currently working on a commercial element now, which hasn't been done before either. So when we launched the website, there'd been no other website which had such a consolidated approach of the information. All the other existing websites were a link off here, a link off there. There was not a one-stop shop, and we wanted to make it easy for people. If you make it easy, people can follow it. And the other thing was, we wanted to make it non-scary, the old ostrich effect. If it's too scary, people stick their head in the sand. They don't want to know. So we wanted to make it easy. And part of that process was we developed an experiential communication tool called Betty. She's a portable parkable house on wheels. She's a trailer that was turned into a little house. And we wanted to be able to educate people with a visual reference. And we thought, oh, we could always bring in half a house to Martin Place and do a media call around that. And then we thought, hold on, if the house has asbestos in it, that's not a good thing. What can we do? And we thought, oh, with our arts background, we thought, okay, let's build a model that's portable. And we spoke with builders and they just didn't get it. They said, so you want a house that's like a caravan but doesn't have plumbing? And it's like, yes, a model house. So why don't you just use a caravan? And it's like, well, no. It's about actually demonstrating a visual reference to a house. So we spoke with a set designer who was incredible, Nick Catron. He was fantastic. And he and us, we designed Betty and he built her. And she's got a bathroom and a kitchen, a living space, a man shed, dog kennel, and an attic. So, and she's kind of quirky, and she kind of breaks down that fear barrier, and she's been hugely successful. She's done over 50,000 Ks around the country. So last Asbestos Awareness Month, from October to November, we trucked her up to Darwin and she did a tour all through the Northern Territory, all through South Australia, then came back through far west New South Wales. So she's a fantastic tool. Whenever she's out on the road, the traffic to the website spikes by 40%. So it's really, she's phenomenal. And everyone loves her. We've got people from England that have come out with these Britain Loves Betty signs and all this sort of stuff. So it's that's one thing we really like about our campaigns. We can be really creative with them.
Yeah.
And
it's great that you guys have the creativity behind that. It's your background, it seems like, yours and your mum's.
Yeah. So because we do have that background, I think it makes us it makes us stand out a bit from competitors in that respect.
Absolutely. Look, how do you measure, you sort of touched on this before, but how do you measure a successful campaign?
That's a very difficult question. Traditionally, a campaign was measured by the number of media clips that you had and the number of pictures you made. That is not an effective measurement at all. That just... It's just basic metrics. It doesn't actually tell you. So hypothetically, if you got 100 media clips, if you got 100 media clips in an area where you didn't really need them and they're not actually going to reach your target audience, it's clearly not successful. So what we do is we evaluate each media piece. in terms of where it was, the size of it, the number of key messages that are in it, did it actually reach the target demographic? But then also, have they actually acted on your key messages? So for us, it's about driving traffic to the website. Mm-hmm. It's about getting asbestos removalists in. It's about contacting your local council for more information. So how we measure is the asbestos campaign, for example, is the number of calls to work cover about, or safe work, about questions about asbestos, the number of calls to councils, how asbestos removalists, if they've noticed an increase in inquiries, same with occupational hygienists, as well as within the areas that we run, if there's been an increase of communication within that community as well.
So it's really far-reaching.
It's far-reaching, the way to measure it. That's what we do. It's quite time-consuming and very detailed. And you can never fully know how effective it is. And the really difficult component with asbestos is, like, the campaign's won a number of international awards, and the feedback is always, but how many lives have you saved? It's like, well, with asbestos-related diseases, they don't kick in for 20 to 40 years. So in 20 to 40 years' time, we can give you that statistic. But at this point in time, we can't. But we can say that the traffic to the website, the number of downloads, the number of people interacting with our message, the number of inquiries, the increase of jobs for removalists has increased. So therefore, they are getting the message and it's happening. So, but it was really interesting. We were meeting with a potential new client and we were talking about what campaigns we do. And he said, oh, you do the asbestos one. Yeah, you're not supposed to drill it. You're not supposed to saw it. You don't do this, you don't do this. And he just rattled them all off. And Mum was just sitting next to me with this big grin on her face. And he said, why are you smiling? And she said, I wrote that. And you know it.
The message has gotten
through. So, and I remember one time, because Betty does a lot of community tours, regional tours, and Our partner is the Asbestos Diseases Research Institute, ADRI, so she's known as Betty the ADRI House. And one of the directors there, Victoria, she's got a mum that lives up at Port Macquarie. In that region, there's quite a bit of asbestos. And she had a call saying, oh, yeah, all my girlfriends were down at Bunnings and they saw Betty. Really cool. And it was just quite phenomenal that the message is actually getting all the way out there. So
it's incredible. Look, I just wanted to finish by congratulating you. You're awarded a silver in the International Association for Measurement and Evaluation of Communication.
Yes.
Young Professional of the Year Awards.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Why was this a global industry first, and why is it unique for someone in public relations to win this award?
Well, the majority of members of AMEC, that's the abbreviation version, are media analysts, so people that work at media monitoring companies, and they deal with the facts and the figures and the statistics and all that sort of stuff. And that's traditionally who has won this award. They do have PR categories for the other awards, and it was, you know, it was suggested that we nominate me. And I thought, yeah, not a chance. And then they listed the nominees and it was like, oh my God. There were, I was one of six. The other four of them were from multi-million-dollar multinational companies.
Wow.
That were like global organizations. And then there was this other guy who works in Copenhagen, and I think their agency covers just a few countries in Germany, in Europe. And then there was me, and I was the only PR person there. They were all media analysts. So I thought, not a chance, no way. And I was just delighted to be a finalist, actually. I thought, that's it, I'm the best PR person in this area, so I'm happy with that. Totally shocked and surprised. And when we got there and they came up for the award, and they said this was actually one of the most hotly competed categories this year. And we've decided to award two winners, which is the first time. And my name came up, and then the guy's name came up, who was actually really pleased. He was who I was barracking for, because I thought it would be really good. He was the only guy as well.
Yeah.
All the rest of us girls, and it's a highly female area industry. So it was really great to see him win that. But I couldn't be more shocked or surprised. So, and totally delighted as well.
And it must be also validating for all the hard work that you've been
doing.
It is.
And like, I mean, our campaigns, we don't have the millions of dollars of budget to be doing all this paid research and analytics and all of that sort of thing. It's the way that we approach our evaluation and our measurement and what we look at, and what tools, what tactics we use, it was recognised. So it was really humbling, really rewarding, and a huge surprise. And it was also really nice. Mum was ridiculously proud.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Alice.
Thank you so much.
That was PR consultant and director of Insight Communications, Alice Collins. The show is produced with the support of the University of Technology Sydney and 2SER 107.3.